Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Ukraine Calling. I'm Alexandra Wyszert for Romadske Radio in Kyiv. We're bringing you our feature interview, followed by some new music. In this interview, our host Bogdan Mihailo will be talking to Melinda Herring, editor of the Atlantic Council's Ukraine Alert blog and senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. In this week's episode, we will be talking about how Capitol Hill has perceived the Ukrainian elections thus far. Additionally, we will be keeping up with the newest developments regarding Ukraine's path towards Euro-Atlantic integration.
Welcome to our in-depth discussion. This week, we're going to be talking to Melinda Herring, editor of Atlantic Council's Ukraine Alert blog. She's also a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute in Washington. Welcome, Melinda.
Thank you so much, Bogdan. Great to be here.
The obvious question, what brings you to Ukraine at this springtime?
Well, frankly, I don't come here when there's snow on the ground. After spending 18 years in Alaska, I don't particularly like the winter here. I love the spring, but I'm here, seriously, I'm here for the Kyiv Security Forum. The Atlantic Council is a partner of the Kyiv Security Forum, and we're doing a panel on U.S. foreign policy under Donald Trump.
Okay, tell us, or those listeners who don't know what the Atlantic Council is, what it represents. A think tank, I presume.
Yes. We are one of the largest think tanks in Washington. And a think tank is basically a university without students. So we produce reports, short articles, and we hold events on various foreign policy issues. And the Atlantic Council is the biggest and strongest voice on Ukraine in Washington.
But it's not only Ukraine.
No, it's a global think tank, so it focuses on the world. But most of the think tanks in Washington are very Russia focused, and we're distinctively Ukraine focused. Our boss is the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. He was here during the Orange Revolution, and that's one of the things that makes us distinctive.
Okay, I've noticed myself. I read your publications. You've got a very impressive group of contributors. How do you keep the right balance in your coverage of Ukraine?
A combination of things. So I try to come to Ukraine four times a year, and that's always helpful. I talk to everyone. I talk to other writers to get story ideas. I live in Washington, so it can be challenging to stay on top of everything that's happening here. And Ukraine is very dynamic. There's been a lot of changes. It's a challenge to stay on top of the war as well. I haven't been able to go out there. We also don't pay our contributors. I have fabulous contributors.
Yeah, let's mention a few of them. There's Adrian Karaknitsky, Alex Mortal, Peter Dickinson, mm-hmm. based in Kyiv, and others that write on Ukraine.
John Herbst, Sandy Vershbaugh, former distinguished diplomats, and as well as a lot of civil society activists here in town as well that write for us. We have politicians who write for us. We've had European politicians. And we have been doing this project for 5 years. It started right after Crimea, and there was a dearth of English language information on Ukraine, and the situation was changing so quickly. RFURL was doing great work, but we thought...
Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
That's right. And they have a wonderful blog in English, Ukraine in Crisis. Christopher Miller here, I think, is the best English language writer on Ukraine and always on top of things. But we needed to do something more regular. So it started right after Crimea. I was not the editor at the time, and they were doing a lot of translations. That was the first year, and then I stepped in the second year. I've been the editor for 4 years, and we've covered the reform debates in a lot of depth.
What's your own background? Do you have a regional specialization or...
So I'm a political scientist. I have a couple degrees in political science. And to me, Ukraine is fascinating because it's a social science laboratory. Everything is changing. Everything is possible. That's one of the reasons why I'm really fascinated with Ukraine. I moved here 11 years ago to teach English. My boyfriend at the time was a Fulbrighter, and he was having a lot more fun than I was having. And he said, come to Ukraine. So I came to Ukraine, and I got a job teaching English in Rusonica at the American English Center. And I was freelance writing at the time, so I would take stories. I went to Gagauzia and wrote for Radio Free or Radio Liberty. I did a piece at Kyiv Polytech on rising anti-Semitism, but there were some problems at the time.
Unpleasant features from the ultra right, shall we say?
Manifestation. That's a good way to describe it. There you go.
Yes,
but
tactful.
I intended to stay for 6 months, and I ended up staying for a year and a half. So you know, everyone says you foreigners never leave. You can't get enough of Ukraine, and that's sort of what happened to me.
Okay, tell us. So, who are the audience? Who reads the material that you produce?
So we have 4,000 subscribers, but some of our articles, one of our articles by Peter Dickinson got more than 1 million hits last year.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah. So what we do is we have content sharing agreements with just about everyone. All editors want comma perfect content. They want a content that's beautiful, well-written, and well-reported. And we have that, and we offer it to other people for free. So for a long time, we were working with Newsweek, and they gave us big hits. We also work with Novo Vremya. We work with the Kyiv Post. We work with Liga.net. And there's not that many journalists in Kyiv right now. So the fact that we have a broad scope of writers, people who are well-known, makes us very attractive for those republications.
Yeah, that's very important, because there's still this tendency to have people in Moscow or in other centers, even Washington, New York, reporting on Ukraine, which is, it was understandable in the Soviet era, but now is hard to comprehend.
So our main audience, though, to answer your question, is the diplomatic community, policymakers in Brussels, in Washington, in Kyiv. Benkova reads us. The Zelensky campaign reads us. We've been doing this for so long that people take us really seriously. And the fact that we have such a strong stable of writers and we're on top of things means that people read us and treat the publication with a lot of respect.
Okay, I'm talking to Melinda Herring, editor of Atlantic Council's Ukraine Alert blog. Now, Melinda, let's broaden the subject a little bit. Let's talk about interest or lack of interest or enduring interest in Ukraine, in the States, in Washington, per se. Have you noticed any differences in the attention span that's given to Ukraine these days?
I wish I could say that there was a lot of enthusiasm and interest in Ukraine in Washington, but I don't think that's the case. On Capitol Hill, there's definitely strong support for Ukraine, and the President Petro Poroshenko has a lot of strong relationships, and the administration has done a good job telling people what's going on here. But in general, I think there is a sense that everything is very complicated. There's a lot of disappointment that the reforms didn't go as far and as deep as we all expected. I mean, there's a core group of people in Washington who are very interested in Ukraine. The elections definitely gave it a bit of a boost. We just had a big event at the Atlantic Council last Monday, and it was a packed house. But in general, I work with Ukrainians who come to Washington all the time, and they look at me and say, why is everyone obsessed with Russia? No one knows anything about Ukraine. So there are not very many people who work on Ukraine full-time, and it's hard to sustain interest, frankly.
But I suppose there's a lot of concern that the war, Russia's war against Ukraine, is continuing. Crimea continues to be occupied. Sanctions, or rather their continued application, remains a hot topic, certainly in Europe and probably to a lesser extent in Washington. But that, on the one hand, the war, and shall we say, replying appropriately to Russia's behavior. And then on the other hand, you've suggested that there is a certain amount of disappointment with the lack of progress, or shall we say, completion of some of the reform efforts that have been started over the last 5 years. How do you square these two?
In terms of interest, people are definitely concerned about the war. They're watching sanctions. But in general, the war's at a stalemate. It's not changing that much. The situation in Crimea is not changing that much. So there's not a whole lot to say about that. I mean, you could always talk about different policy options to try to change Russian behavior. And I think that's an interesting conversation. The reform picture, that's a hot topic. It is constantly changing. Sometimes it's two steps forward, one step back. So we're definitely on top of that. But
is the issue of Ukraine's closer integration into Euro-Atlantic structures, eventually one day maybe even NATO, somewhere down the road, is that being discussed, or is that on the back burner for now?
I think it's on the back burner. It's gonna take years and years. I mean, I think we need to talk about the incremental steps Ukraine needs to take to get to that point.
And do you see any split in the attention levels along partisan lines, Republicans, Democrats, or is there a unified group of people, regardless of who's president, that are interested or remain concerned?
In general, on Capitol Hill, there's a Ukraine caucus, and there's strong bipartisan interest in Ukraine. There's strong bipartisan interest in the nefarious activities of Russia. I don't expect that to change, regardless of who's president.
and looking forward, if there is a change here, will there be panic or, shall we say, confusion in Washington? Or are people slowly preparing for the possibility of a change?
I don't think it's going to be that dramatic, honestly. There's a lot of questions about who Volodymyr Zelensky is. He's not come to Washington yet. He hasn't sent any of his representatives to Washington yet. There's a lot of questions about his background. There's questions about how close he is to Kolomoisky. But in general, I don't think this is an election about foreign policy. This is an election about domestic issues. It's a question of Poroshenko's unfulfilled promises, the poor performance of the economy, the reforms that were never carried to fulfillment. So in general, you know, you can debate foreign policy differences between Poroshenko and Zelensky. And some people are trying to make it, in my opinion, try to make those differences more stark. But at the end of the day, they both support membership to NATO and to the EU, and they're going to both be tough on Russia.
So really, this is not an election here, and it's not perceived as such in Washington as being about direction, about orientation, westward orientation. It's more about how the country's been managed or not.
That's right. So the existential question was settled, right? Ukraine's foreign policy is settled. You guys have all, I mean, we followed this. Something very good happened this year. The constitutional amendments were passed to enshrine NATO membership and a desire for EU membership into the Constitution. It's settled. And a majority of Ukrainians favor both NATO and EU membership. So, frankly, I don't see why Zelensky is talking about a referendum. Why are we even relitigating this? Ukrainians have given far too much to relitigate this.
Perhaps it's a temporary move to placate East and South Ukraine. Any lingering fears that there might be about some, you know, sharp thrust westward. I suspect, but who knows? Look, I wanted to ask you about concerns about interference, not only through the internet in America's domestic politics, the election there, but continuing interference in terms of creating images of Ukraine. Do you think in the States that these pro-Russian trolls are still active in creating this image of Ukraine as a virtually failed state, a state where confusion prevails, where corruption is so rampant? That is to turn people off, those who would be inclined to support. Or has that diminished in the last year or two?
Frankly, there's so little knowledge of Ukraine in Washington, in the United States, that I think that's probably the wrong way to look at it. Ukraine needs to do more and more to tell its story. Ukraine has an amazing story to tell. It has so much potential, and I think there's a lot that could be done to express what Ukraine has done in the IT sector, in fashion, in agriculture, and you know, it's the soft diplomacy that I think is really important. If you step outside of these elite foreign policy circles, a lot of people don't know anything about Ukraine. They still associate it with Russia. They don't know what happened in the last 5 years, and the attention span is very short. So I would say that cultural diplomacy is the best way to tell Ukraine's story, and it hasn't been done effectively in the last 5 years.
Do you sense, from your vantage point as the editor of the Atlantic Council's chief publication on Ukraine, is there any interest, do you think, in American political circles, foreign policy circles, to revamp, shall we say, improve, embellish, enhance the Minsk process by including the States and perhaps Britain, moving towards what Zelensky and Tymoshenko suggested, the so-called Budapest forum, because we've seen Germany replying and France in the last 2 or 3 days that's not on, that they're not in favor of that. But do you think that there are elements within the policymaking community that would at least think about this possibility?
Not that I've heard of. The general line is we need to stick with Minsk. It's not working that well, but we need to stick with it. And I think we need to be more creative, frankly. But, of course, sanctions are tied to Minsk. So there's, I think, a reluctance to try anything new.
Okay, we're running out of time already. So if you were giving advice, let's say A, Poroshenko, B, Zelensky, in terms of the pitch on the foreign policy scene if they're elected. Any damage that has to be undone, messages that have to be sent, or new signals. In short, what would you advise both candidates if you were their advisor? Somebody looking from a Washington vantage point, knowing more or less what is needed and what Washington would be receptive to.
First, I think that the new president has to do some damage control. For the last 3 weeks, Ukraine has not looked very good in the international press. So we've had the Lutsenko interview, which made Ukraine look pretty poor.
This is the Procurator General saying that the U.S. ambassador had given him a list of untouchables here, people that cannot be moved against because they have U.S. support.
That's right. That's right. So you had that. Then we've had this prolonged video versus video debate, and you know, the refusal to debate. Then now we're debating, and in general, the headlines have basically been in all the international press: Ukraine is about to elect a comedian. No, it's not a joke. I think it's time for a more serious tone. That would be the first piece of advice that I would take. But in general, Ukraine has to get serious about its domestic reforms. That's the biggest thing that Ukraine has to do in the next 5 years.
Put its house in order.
Ukraine must put its house in order. It has to get the economy going again. It's growing at 3.25%. It's not enough. It's the poorest country in Europe now. It's poorer than Moldova. And it doesn't have to be that way. That's the worst part of this. It breaks my heart to see Ukraine not growing and getting its house in order, because it has every potential to do that.
And what are we looking for from Zelensky? Reassurances that there will be no shift towards Russia, or that reforms will continue? What do you think his priority should be?
In the next 2 weeks, he needs to name a serious foreign policy advisor. He doesn't have any foreign policy or national security advisors. And that's one thing that a lot of us in Washington are really worried about, given what's happening here, given how serious the threat is, given that we think that Putin will probably test him right away. He has to get a real security advisor, you know, today or yesterday. But beyond that, I think everyone wants to know what his real plans are. He has some good advisors on anti-corruption and on judicial reform, but we don't know if he's going to hire them, right? That's one of the big questions. Is he using them, or is he actually, is he sending a signal? These are the kinds of people I want around me. I hope that's the signal that he's sending, that these are the kinds of people that will be surrounding me, but only time will tell. We're going to keep watching and see how close will the Kolomoisky people be to Zelensky. That's really the big question and the big signal.
Melinda, we've come to an end, more or less. Traditionally, I ask my guests to share their final thoughts. It can be a message, it can be words of advice. What would you like to say to our audience out there in cyberspace?
I hope that you read Ukraine Alert, and we'll be watching and following. So thanks for having me.
Thanks very much. I've been talking to Melinda Herring, editor of Atlantic Council's Ukraine Alert blog and a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute in Washington. Thanks very much, Melinda.
Thank you.
With all the tensions in Ukraine surrounding the presidential election campaign, it's a good idea to take a break. Here's some upbeat music by the ethno-rock band Vasya Club. It's one of their classic pieces called Chorna Gora, a mountain in the Carpathian Mountains, but it's also about the Black Sea. Enjoy.
Чорне море, чорне море. Гарне море, гарне море. Чорне море. Неня моя чорна гора. Гей, гей, гей. Ніхто не зна, ніхто не зна. Гей, гей. Де сховалося місяце, не зна. Гей, гей. Гей, стріляй, моя рушениця, щоб почула моя киця. Неня моя чорна гора. Щоб почула молодиця, неня моя чорна гора. Гей, гей, гей. Чекай, куме, гей.
чорна гора. Гей, гей, гей. Віта Маріто, Маргаріто, ми з кумом два бандіта, за неї нині чорна гора. Гей, гей, гей. Чуєш, Іван, не мій сіне, гей, гей. З полонини пісняліне, гей, гей. Гей, я ніколи і нікому не віддам рідного дому, за неї нині чорна гора.
Next week, we'll be bringing you another topical interview with the host Bogdan Mihajlo, so be sure to tune in for a new episode. And we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@romatskeradio.org. I'm Alexander Wyszert for Romatske Radio in Kyiv. Thank you so much for listening.